You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, today on the show, we have million-dollar screenwriter Diane Drake. Diane is the writer of films like Only You, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Marissa Tomei, as well as What Women Want, the second highest grossing romantic comedy ever. And Diane has written a new book called Get Your Story Straight. And we're going to talk about her book, her trials and tribulations in the business, as well as getting down to the nitty-gritty of what it's really like to be a Hollywood screenwriter. And spoiler alert, it's not always peaches and cream working as a screenwriter in Hollywood. So she really is very upfront and honest and really open about her experience for the last couple decades working in the business. And her story is mixed with extreme highs, like when she was paid $1 million for Only You, to extreme lows, and we'll talk about a little bit about that as well. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Diane Drake. I'd like to welcome to the show Diane Drake. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's my pleasure.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. Before we even get started, I have to say how much I love your first screenplay.
Thanks.
The Only You. It is for all of those listening who don't know that movie, Only You is starting a very young and baby-faced Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And Marissa Tomei and Bonnie Hunt. Yes, mm-hmm. As well. Oh, and Billy Zane, if I remember correctly,
yes,
is in that movie as well.
And Billy Zane, yes.
And the reason I bring it up first is because it was during my video store days when I first saw that movie. And of course, I had a huge crush on Marissa Tomei because everybody of my generation has that crush. Without question. So when that movie came out, I was just like, oh my God. But it was honestly the first experience, the first time I actually fell in love with Italy, because it was shot so beautifully. The director, Jewison, right?
Yes, the director was Norma Jewison, and the cinematographer was Sven Nykvist, who was legendary. I mean, he did Ingmar Bergman's movies, and he'd done Woody Allen's movies. And I think the only reason he did this movie was because it was Italy.
Yeah,
we had a lot of people who wanted to work on that movie because it was Italy.
It's a rough shoot.
You know, I tell you, I was no fool, but I'll tell you something about that. So I when I came up with the idea, I was very much in love with Italy. I'd been there once, mm-hmm. briefly, and I really loved it, and I wanted to go back. So it was sort of a vicarious, you know, fantasy of mine. But the other thing was that I had realized that I felt at the time, and I could be wrong about this, but I don't think so, that you really hadn't seen Italy on the big screen in a while. Mm-hmm. And the only place you had seen it was in like indie movies, like Cinema Paradiso, or there was a lovely, lovely movie. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I love it, called Enchanted April.
Yeah, I remember that movie, yeah.
Oh, it's such a beautiful movie.
Beautiful film.
So, and I knew by virtue of the nature of the story that it had to go somewhere, right? And I didn't, you know, she had to take off. And I didn't want to go from LA to New York or whatever, right? I really wanted to go to Italy. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to send her to Italy. And in fact, I don't know if you remember, but they travel all through Italy, and kind of late in the movie, they go to Positano. And I had never been to Positano. So I sent them to Positano because I wanted to go to Positano. But the one other little wrinkle of this is that when I was writing that script and I was down and out, I was unemployed, I had one little tiny sale. I'd gotten in the Writers Guild. We can talk more about that if you want. But but I was struggling. And a really close friend of mine whose work I really respected a lot, and he was a script ahead of me. And we'd both worked in development prior to this, and we were both out of work. And I just really – I trusted his judgment. And so I was kind of having problems with the script, as one does. Mm-hmm. And he very sort of cockily said to me, you know, he's like, well, send it to me. I'll read it. We'll have brunch. I'll tell you. I'll give you my notes. You know, I'll help you fix it. Mm-hmm. So we did that. And his notes were really good. I knew that – I was so funny too, because I literally just pulled them out. I hadn't looked at them in a million years. But I knew it meant I was going to have to tear the script apart. And that would be difficult, but I knew it would make it better. So I was okay with that. But the other thing he said to me was, but don't set it in Italy. And I was like, why? Why not set it in Italy? And he's like, because if you set it in Italy, it just becomes a movie about Italy. So there's a little lesson for you. You know, take what is useful for you and leave the rest, because I just felt like, no, you're wrong about that. To me, that was one of the great joys of it. Mm-hmm. Certainly as writing it. And I think it has been for people watching it. And I will tell you, that movie's done really, really well in DVD. Whatever, I don't know if they stream it now. But I think a large part of the reason, obviously, Robert, of course, you know, come on. But also
Robert circa 1994 is not Robert circa 2018.
No, but he was a big star already.
He was a star. No, was that before or after Chaplin? I think that was before.
I was actually, let me think about it for a minute. I think it was before.
I think it was before Chaplin and before he had his problems.
Between us, he had some problems then. But here's the thing. In spite of that, he was extraordinarily professional, extraordinarily kind. I can tell you the sweetest story about him, if you want me to later, that to this day makes me kind of cry. I mean, he was lovely. He was lovely. He may have had his own demons at the time, but he was amazing. And I think that's part of the reason there was so much goodwill for him, you know, in Hollywood.
I know, right?
You know, because he's just such a gracious, kind, gifted person. Yeah.
No question. I had the pleasure of meeting him once at Sundance, and he was just such a darling. He was no reason to be nice to me. I was just a little, you know, guy just walking up like, hey, can I get a picture? Can I talk? And he was such a sweet man. But I do love that movie, and the magic between him and Marissa were just wonderful in that film. But before we go off on a tangent, because we could talk about Only You for the rest of this episode. First and foremost, how did you get into the business?
Okay, so it depends how far back you want to go, but basically, I'll try to make it briefish. When I got out of college, I had a degree in communications visual arts, and it was kind of worthless, you know, in the marketplace. It wasn't worthless to me. You know, I had no connections or anything. And so I thought, well, I guess I'll be practical because my BA is not real practical, and I'll get an MBA because that's what everyone was doing. And I guess that seemed like a good idea. And I hated it with passion. And I remember sitting in my accounting class and thinking, if I survive this and this is going to qualify me to do this for the rest of my life, and I don't want to do this. So I quit. And which was really hard because I'd been a pretty good student up to that point. And you know, it's like I'd taken out loans and everything, but it just wasn't for me. So that was not in California. That was in Colorado. So I moved back to California and decided I would go to law school because that seemed practical. But I thought, but I'll do it in California and I'll do entertainment law and that'll be kind of sort of cool and it'll be practical too. And so I got a job in the legal department at what was then Columbia Pictures and applied. And I looked around and I saw how miserable a lot of the people in the legal department looked. And meanwhile, I got into USC and I got on the waiting list for UCLA, but I didn't want to spend the money to go to USC. And I ultimately did not get into UCLA. And I thought, oh, that's okay. I mean, I don't know that I want to do this anyway. And so that it was at that point that I first learned, because I was working on the lot, that there was such a job as being a reader. I didn't know that that job even existed when started. So I thought, well, I could do that, and that's how I started. And I started as a reader and worked freelance as a reader and worked my way up, did acquisitions for an independent company for a while. And then my last job before I started writing was I was a VP of creative affairs for director Sidney Pollack. Mm-hmm. And, at the time, it was a really good spec sale era.
Yes, it was.
And I can go into more about how I wound up leaving there. But basically, I just kind of looked around and I thought, well, that looks like a pretty good life. Like this writer was off on a cruise around South America. I mean, it seemed very glamorous, because they were feature writers and they were at the top of their game. And so, it was like, well, and here I was sitting in judgment on these people's work. But having said that, to be a critic... to write about writing is a lot easier than writing. Let me just say, so it is a different skill in a way. And I think the thing that I lacked, and I wound up having a little talk with myself about it, was confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think by that point, I had read an awful lot of scripts and I felt like I had a relatively good understanding of the process, at least intellectually. And I would read stuff that I thought, not necessarily stuff that our company was working on, but, just stuff around town that it's old or, was getting heat or whatever. And I would think it wasn't that great, and these guys, and in most cases they were guys, did not know as much as I did. But then I had to realize, but they're doing it and you're not.
Fair enough. Well, can you talk a little bit about that time in the late 80s and early 90s, which was the script, the spec script boom, which, in today's world is just unheard of. I mean, yeah, there still are million-dollar scripts, and there are still spec scripts that get bought. But people don't understand. Because I was just coming into the business going to film school, but you would read about, obviously, Shane Black kind of cracked open, and Joe Esterhaus, those guys – just busted the door open for like $2, $3, $4, $5 million buys.
Yeah, it's not kind of out of control, to be honest. But I mean, it's sad to me that there was a time that to be original commanded a premium, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now that's pretty much the last thing they want, that particularly the studios. I mean, it's just not what it's about at this point. It's about intellectual property. It's about anything that's already been successful as something else. And they're not in the business of making the sort of movies I used to write, and I used to go see, to be honest, my favorite kind of movies, the movies like Jim Brooks made, those kind of movies. That's not what they do anymore. They don't want to spend $50 million to make $150 million. They want to spend $300 million to make $1 billion. And it's unfortunate, and I mean, there's work to be had out there, but it's pretty much to work on that, to work on intellectual property. You write an original so you can get a job writing something that's already been something else, I think. Mm-hmm. I will say, I'm sure and probably your listeners know, there's kind of two businesses now. There's the studio model, which again is $300 million to make $1 billion, franchise merchandising, tentpole, mostly superheroes, right?
Right.
Handful of people like Judd Apatow, who are sort of a brand unto themselves that can kind of get away with that little middle ground movie.
Tyler Perry and those kind of guys. Yeah, there's a handful.
But there's a franchise. You know what I mean? Like Tyler Perry's, it's franchise. I mean, Apatow, you could almost say it's franchise. It's not quite, but they're a brand. Let's put it that way.
Blumhouse and things like that.
I mean, when I wrote Only You, I hadn't sold anything. I had written one script and, it got me an agent, very small agent, and he got me one meeting and I got the job, which is miraculous to me in hindsight too, you know, just, it was just to write a little treatment. So, but it's 25 grand. It got me in the Writers Guild at the time, got me insurance, bought me the year to write Only You. But so I was nobody is my point. Mm-hmm. And yet my agent, and my agent was coming off a hot sale. He had just sold a script for like $500,000. So he was kind of, even though it was a smaller agency, he was kind of a name at that point, but still Julia Roberts' agent wanted Only You for her. Demi Moore wanted it. I mean, you could not get to stars of equivalent caliber now if you were nobody, you know, mm-hmm. and get your script read in a day or two. That's how it used to be. That's how big a market there was, and how much of demand there was for original material.
It's insane.
Yeah. Times have changed. I'm so sorry to say, but, and this doesn't necessarily affect me, at least not yet, but TV, streaming.
Well, Netflix, I mean, Netflix is now the 800-pound gorilla, and they're doing things that, you know, I mean, it's amazing. They came in and just completely have changed the game.
They've changed the game. And so, you know, now there's Amazon.
Apple.
Yeah, exactly. I just taught an advanced class for UCLA, and a manager came in to speak who was lovely, and she was talking about Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. And you know how that there's going to be that, and that's a lot of intellectual property too. But apparently, they're looking to make some originals as well, which kind of shocked me. And in that $40-50 million range, which kind of almost no one's doing. Although somebody was telling me, well, Netflix is doing that too. Netflix is doing everything. But
I was looking at. I still always remember that film that just came out this last Christmas, which was the Kurt Russell Santa Claus movie.
Yes. That's right.
Which was direct. Yeah. Santa Claus, whatever. I forgot the name of it, but
I think it was Chronicles. I can't remember.
Yeah. Chronicles of Santa Claus or whatever it was. But regardless, we'll see it every year for the rest of our lives now. Yeah. But it was directed by Chris Columbus, and that was easily a $150 million film.
Oh, to make it?
Yeah.
Oh,
I guess. It was a lot of visual effects in that. It's over 100. It's over 100. And you still got Kurt Russell, who's.
I don't think it was, but regardless,
it could have been released theatrically without question. It would have probably made $250 million.
It would have been in the olden days. I'll tell you something about a Christmas movie though. I wrote a Christmas movie with a partner a few years ago, and because I thought, you know, let me just do intellectual property, right? Like Santa, it's public domain, it's intellectual property, everybody knows the story. So a partner and I rewrote like a Santa Claus origin story. You know, and basically like how he met Mrs. Claus, how the reindeer learned to fly. Yeah, like cool. It's kind of fun, right?
Fun.
And I like, we haven't seen this in a long time. We haven't seen a new Santa Claus. You know, even friends who weren't in the business were like, oh, that's really fun, you know. And it was basically the idea that he started off as a con man and a cat burglar, and that's why he was so good at breaking into places.
Genius.
And so you've got this great character arc, and, you know, you have fun with like how all these things came to be. So I thought that seemed pretty marketable. And I sent it to an agent who said, who I could tell – between us had not even read it. And I could tell that because it starts with Santa as a little kid, but it's only for like the first five or so pages. And then you cut to him as an adult, not as an old man, but as an adult. And he's like, well, you can't do Santa as a kid. And so I had to kind of be like, not rude and saying, well, he's really not, you know, it's just the first few pages. And, you know, and then he said, and this was the critical thing. This was a few years ago now. But he said, well, you can't do a Santa Claus movie anyway, because they don't celebrate Christmas in China.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
There you have it. That's the extent to which the money and the marketplace is dictating what gets made. Because when I was first in the business, global market, US was, you know, 2/3, foreign was 1/3. Mm-hmm. And now that's reversed. Mm-hmm. Foreign is 2/3, US is 1/3. And of that 2/3, a lot of that's China. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is action. I thought, well, I guess that's why we haven't seen another Christmas movie on the big screen then since Elf. I couldn't think of a scene since Elf. You know how long ago that was?
That was so, early 2000s, wasn't it?
I guess. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if John Favreau wanted to make Elf too, they would be happy to let him. But aside from that, I don't think we'll see it. And so it was so interesting to see that Christmas Chronicles thing. Uh-huh. And my partner and I even talked about it, about dusting ours off. But honestly, it needs more work than I like to call it.
Yeah. And if we go down Christmas movies, then, you know, the Disney Channel, Hallmark has those things so on lock on those low budgets.
They do. But getting back to what kind of kicked this off was, you know, we had Flying Reindeer and stuff. So that was the other thing. It was like, it couldn't be made cheaply, we thought, because you were going to have those visual effects. You were going to have, you know, it was not a cheap movie to make. So yeah, that was kind of interesting, but it was funny too, because both my movies had been remade in China with Chinese stars. And so I kind of felt like, but they like me in China. I mean, why can't I give it a shot?
It's fascinating. I mean, fascinating the way the marketplace has changed so much. And then such a kind of ignorant comment by that agent. It's like, oh, they don't celebrate Christmas in China. That's such a Hollywood LA thing to say.
So marketing driven, right? Oh. But who knows? But here's the thing. Here's the reality. He's got his finger more in the marketplace than I do. He knows what buyers are looking for, one assumes. Now, obviously, again, nobody knows anything and all that. But sure. I mean, I did feel it was dismissive. And I did feel that, like, you know, it was like, really? And yet, when I stopped to think about it, I thought, well, and maybe that's why we haven't had another. Because it used to be like every few years you'd get a new Christmas movie. I mean, all those Tim Allen movies and Elf, you know, and we haven't seen it. We haven't seen a big family action comedy Christmas movie. That's why Christmas Chronicles
blew up.
Was a huge deal, I think.
Yeah.
You know, because and people, you know, Kurt Russell, people who used to go to those movies when they were younger and now they've got kids or grandkids or whatever, you know, and they remember him. And it was kind of genius casting that way.
Yeah, and then Chris Columbus is no slouch as a director.
Well, yeah, the kind of movies he makes, right? But it's so interesting that, of course, it was not released theatrically. Like, they didn't sell that theatrically.
No, they could have easily. If that would have been released, they would have easily made a couple hundred million, $200-300 million.
Do you think so? See, I think you're right. Maybe you're right. But I think the prevailing wisdom was, you know, and that's why it was Netflix. I don't think it cost as much as you think.
I think you might be right. I think it's at least 80, because just to get Kurt Russell and Chris out of bed, it's going to cost a couple bucks. I don't know.
It would be interesting to see. We should look that up.
After this interview, I will look it up.
Research people on that.
Now, you also said you work for Sidney Pollack, who is obviously a legendary director. And I'm a huge fan of not only him as an actor, as a director, but also him as an actor. You know, him and Eyes Wide Shut. I love his stories with Stanley and all that kind of stuff. What was it like working for a legend like that? What did you learn from him?
Well, first of all, sadly, he's no longer with us. But he was difficult. Mm-hmm. And extremely demanding, but because he was extremely demanding of himself, you know, and driven, you know, and kind of brilliant. I mean, he really was one of the smartest people I've ever met. He could be very charming. He started as an actor, and he could be not very nice, you know. He could be really, really tough. But I learned so much working there, and I really don't think I would ever become a writer had I not worked there. You know, it was a combination of what I learned and also the fact that I felt like I'd reached the end of the road there and I couldn't. I'll get into that if you'd like. It wasn't him, but it's someone else I was working with there. Just kind of made my life a living hell and I had to get out. And so I, you know, that sort of a gun was put to my head and it was like, well, you know, if you know so much, why don't you see what you can do? But it was great. I mean, to watch him work with writers and he was so articulate and he was so insightful and, you know, yeah, they don't really make him like that. He was pretty great.
They broke the mold with Sidney without question. And just to go back to Only You for a second. I'm sorry. Say that again.
I said he was a great actor, you know, like in Tootsie and Husbands and Wives, you know, and you know, he didn't want to be in Tootsie. He didn't want to play that part.
Right.
But that was Dustin Hoffman who insisted.
As it should have. He was great at it. And just to go back to Only You for one second, that script was the first script you sold and it was a $1 million buy, if I'm not mistaken.
It was.
What was that like?
It was crazy. I mean, God, it was $1 million. It was $1 million up front. It wasn't even like if we make the movie, you know, it was $1 million. And like I said, I think largely because at that moment, at that little tiny window in time, we had Julia Roberts potentially interested and Demi Moore interested. Mm-hmm. And then Norman came on shortly thereafter. I think he came on after the deal was closed. But yeah, I mean, you know, it was just, again, it was a different time. There was a lot of competition for it. You know, the stars aligned in my favor. Yeah, it was kind of surreal. And I remember I was so like just praying that I could sell it at all, that I could get like Writers Guild minimum or something, you know, so that I could continue to be a writer. I mean, I didn't know what else I was going to do at that point. I really didn't think I could go back to working in development. I just had kind of burned out on that. And I just thought, I mean, so yeah. And it happened so fast, you know, because there's a saying in Hollywood, good news travels fast. And I think it's still largely true, maybe not quite as true as it was then, but back in those days, it was like, you know, you get all this heat and, you know, things would happen or not. And so it was really like less than a week from the time it went out to closing that deal.
Now, yeah. What is it like? Because I want, you know, writers listening, you know, you get a $1 million deal, which obviously is a lottery ticket. I mean, it does not happen often. What happens to you in your career afterwards? Like, I know it gives you a career, obviously, but what are the steps like? What are the meetings you're taking? What are the assignments you're picking up? So people understand, like, if so we can live vicariously through you, what it's like after a sale like that.
Well, learn from my mistakes.
Okay.
I did some things right, and I did some things that probably I might have done better or differently. So I obviously kind of came out of nowhere and had a lot of meetings and had a lot of things thrown at me. But, you know, I really was a new writer. I mean, it was my second script. And I'd written the first one while I was still working for Sydney, like in three months at night. It was a talking animal movie. Only it took me about a year. Right. So, you know, I at that point, for better or worse, I felt like, well, I kind of want to work on stuff that I want to work on. You know what I mean? Like, that sort of means something to me. So I probably, in hindsight, had I been totally mercenary, should have just stacked up assignments, should have just like taken whatever came my way and, you know, done the best I could and taken the money and run. But hopeless romantic idealist that I am, I just didn't really feel like I could do that. I didn't know where I would pull it from. You know, I didn't even know how I could do like a bad job on something if I didn't relate to it in some way. So there was actually only one project in that time. I took meetings for about a year. You know, I actually went to Italy while the movie was, I worked on Only You for a while, and I was in Italy for a little while shooting. And then I came back and, you know, I was doing the meeting thing. And there was only one project that I really wanted. And actually Meg Ryan was attached to it. And, she had a deal at Fox, and I didn't really have what they call a quote because I hadn't worked on assignment. So I just had like, you know, well, I have a $1 million sale. So my agent asked for a lot of money, which was fine. But they didn't want to pay it. And it was a movie pretty much starring all women, interestingly, in hindsight. And all the people involved were women. Like it was actually Rosanna Arquette. It was a story of hers. And Meg was going to play Rosanna, and Rosanna was going to play her own best friend. And it was complicated. But anyway, so we came down in price three times. Like, we came in at a certain level and Fox came back really low. And then we came down and Fox came back really low. And then we came down and Fox came back really low. So three times, they never came up a dime. And to me, what that meant was they're never going to make this movie. They don't want this movie. And maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I misread it. But that was my interpretation, that they were placating Meg. They weren't going to tell her no. She had a deal at the studio. But they had no interest in making this. And because I had been so fortunate as to not only sell a script for $1 million, but actually have it go into production, mm-hmm. I kind of thought, well, why do I want to sign on for something that I know they're not excited about to begin with, right? And that was when I walked away and thought, well, you know, you did okay last time writing your own idea, so why don't you come up with something else?
Oh, the ego.
Yeah, well, I know. But here's what happened. So I gave, and if I could only do this now, if only. But at the time, I was younger then, I said, all right, you got a week to come up with something. And that was when I came up with What Women Want.
Wow. And that great segue into What Women Want, which is obviously was a huge hit with starring Mel Gibson, pre-Mel Gibson. And Mel Gibson, yeah. Pre-Mel Gibson. And right. And the lovely, incomparable Helen Hunt, who is amazing in the film. And I remember watching that film 1,000 times. I love that movie. But there was a bit of drama with that movie, wasn't there, for you?
There's a lot of drama with that movie that I am still technically not at liberty to discuss. But let me just say, it was very bittersweet. It was very agonizing, honestly.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Because you have the story credit. You have a story credit on that.
I have a story credit, and I wrote the original script for that movie. And there is no way that should have happened. There is no way, by Writers Guild rules, that should have happened. And that's all I'm going to say for now. But that was a huge, huge battle in my life. And I always say to people, I'm really trying not to do this anymore, but I always say to people when I...
But I'm going to say it anyway.
What?
But I'm going to say it anyway. I normally don't say this, but
I will never get over it. And I will never get over it. But I have to start, I just have to tell myself I'm bigger than that, you know. But the reason it's particularly fresh right now is I just relived it all because it just got remade.
Right.
So I had to deal with the Writers Guild again, and I had to deal with the credit again, and I had to deal with what was done to me on that movie again. And what was done to me was, you know,
brutal.
It was not right. And I'm not the only writer in Hollywood to have had this experience. I know that. I did get paid. I got paid very well for my torture. Right. And the movie got made, you know, and it was a
huge hit.
And all that's to the good. But I have a few bones to pick with a few people, including the Writers Guild, about that movie.
And, you know, and if it makes you feel any better, I also had on the show Paul Castro. I'm not sure if you know who Paul Castro is. He taught over at the UCLA Extension Program for almost 10 years as well. He wrote August Rush.
Okay.
And he wrote the original screenplay and the original story. And he had the exact same thing happen to him. And he does – I mean, he did get the story credit, and he has a story credit, but the producer brought in a bigger screenwriter's name, and then he wanted to take credit, and then there was a Writers Guild battle. And it does happen. It does happen. You know, unless you are an 800-pound gorilla, you know, that's not happening.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, after I sold Only You, I didn't teach or anything. I didn't do the kind of thing I'm doing now, but every once in a while I get asked to speak somewhere, you know, and I'd always get the question like, how do you protect your material? And I would always say, listen, you know, I mean, obviously at the time I was in the guild, I had an agent, I had a lawyer, but still, you know, it's like, you can register your stuff with the guild, even if you're not in the guild, it's like $25. You can register it with the US Copyright Office. And my response was always, it's just easier for them to pay you than to steal it from you, really. Mm-hmm. And then What Women Want happened to me. So yeah, it's there's only so much you can do. And
when you go up against a studio, when you go up against bigger name, for lack of a better term, like, you know, this doesn't happen to Aaron Sorkin or Shane Black, or Quentin Tarantino.
One would hope not. Although I think, I mean, listen, read William Goldman. I mean, they all have their horror stories, even people at the very top, you know, it's just different leagues. But I will say, I feel like, and I always have to like temper this, like, I've been very fortunate. You know, I was fortunate that it sold. I was fortunate that it got made. I was fortunate I got paid. I had a really good attorney. Not good enough as it turned out, but I really do fault the Writers Guild a lot on this. And I'm not the first writer to do that. You know, they do their best, but
it's politics. It's politics, too.
It is politics.
It's all politics.
That's just the reality, and I'm glad the Guild exists, and I appreciate, you know, the residuals and all that. But they're not immune.
No, it's politics. And I think that's one thing that they don't teach in film schools and stuff. They don't understand. I mean, new screenwriters coming up don't understand that, look, there are rules that everyone says there are, and then there's rules that nobody tells you there are until you get slapped across the face with those new rules. And you are a perfect example, and Paul's a perfect example of that, that things happen, especially when egos get involved, especially yeah. when big names get involved. And a lot of times they're like, well, who's that? Well, that's an ant. Let's just crush that and move that out of the way. It does happen. It does happen. It's unfortunate.
It does happen. And it happens far too often. I mean, you know, compared to a lot of what people go through, you know, at least my name is on it. And at least I did.
Yeah, absolutely. You actually have one of the success stories.
Having said that, I mean, you know, it's just, you know, it's funny. I'll do a little segue here. So we'll move on. But one of the things I talk about, and it's only kind of recently come to me, you know, it's interesting teaching, because when you're writing, it's, you know, I assume it's like somebody who's a good tennis player or whatever. It's intuitive, right? They've been doing it so long. And then when you teach it, you have to really break it down when you're trying mm-hmm. to explain to somebody else, you know, how it works. And so I like teaching because you always kind of get new insights. For as long as I've been at this, I'm still like learning stuff myself, you know, there's never ending. But one of the things I've recently kind of concluded, or at least, you know, contemplated, is that I really do believe that in a way stories are about justice, because I think everyone feels like an underdog and everybody recognizes that life is not fair. It's just not. And yet there's something really deep in us, like primal almost, that wants to believe it is. That, you know, is so like, we just like expect it's going to be, but of course it's not. And that's part of the function stories serve, right? Because we want to see people get what they deserve. We want to see the hero get what he deserves. We want to believe there's justice in the world. We want to believe, you know, we want to see the villain get what he deserves. And, you know, and that leads to the whole zeitgeist thing about superheroes now, because I think everybody feels so powerless. But, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, I mean, I always use this as an analogy, because what you just said is a perfect analogy for arguably my favorite film of all time, Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
You saw Shank Redemption. I always, people are like, what is about that movie that, you know, I saw that movie when I was 20 something, where I literally probably still thought Jean-Claude Van Damme was the greatest actor of all time. So there wasn't a sophistication there to see a good story. But yet, even my high school and college friends were liking that movie. I'm like, what is about that story? Like, on paper, it's a horrible title. It's like not.
Title.
Horrible, worst marketing campaign ever. I mean, it's about, you know, in the middle, it just, there's nothing appealing from on the surface about that film. But yet I always tell people that I think people connect with it so much is because it's an analogy for life, where you are Andy Dufresne and you feel like your life sometimes might feel like you're in prison or that it's not fair. And then you get beaten constantly for 20 years, and then he finally escapes, and it's just this cathartic thing.
It's cathartic, yeah.
So that's why I just thought of that when you were saying that, because it was – I feel it's very much – what do you think about it? I'm assuming you like that. If not, you're dead inside and we can't
keep
talking.
No, I really do. I haven't seen it as many times as you have. I remember it. I remember it very fondly. But you're absolutely right that it is a lot of people's favorite movie. Like, you know, if you're on Twitter and people name things, that movie comes up a lot. Mm-hmm. So it really did strike a chord with people. And yeah, getting back to what I was saying, I mean, I think the most powerful people in the world think of themselves as underdogs. You know, it's all relative, right?
When it's all perspective.
When they go into theater, I think they identify with the underdog. And it's funny, you know that poem, and I don't know who it's by, I should know, but into each life some rain must fall. You know that saying? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I only just recently came across the line that precedes that, which I think is really lovely, which is, thy fate is the common fate of all. Into each life some rain must fall.
That's awesome.
It's like, you're not going to be exempt. You are not going to be exempt. And it's going to suck. You know, and so we all have our crosses to bear, so to speak. So, yeah, I do think stories really speak to that, in the desire to believe there is some. I mean, you know, you look at, we build temples to justice, Supreme Court, whatever. We want to believe that matters, even though so often it seems not to.
What is the great fear that you had to overcome to finally be able to put your fingers on that typewriter or on that computer board, on that computer, to actually start writing and put yourself out there as a writer? Because I know a lot of people listening are either just starting out and they just have these I'm a very big mindset guy. So like, it's all about your mindset and what beliefs you have about yourself and the confidence which you spoke about. What was that thing that you finally – what was the dragon that you slayed to get to where you were?
You know, I don't know if I can quite put my finger on the fear, although, like I said, just sort of the general umbrella of lack of confidence, which I think stays with you. You know, I just think stays with writers, period, and probably most creative people, period.
Of course.
You know, I do remember telling myself that I needed to accept the fact that I was not going to probably be able to write to a level that I would really respect, right?
Wow.
Because even though my critical faculties have been pretty well honed, I was just beginning as a writer. So, you know, cut yourself a little bit of slack there, right? You know, you haven't been doing this as long as you've been watching movies. You know, even people who don't do development for a living, don't analyze material for a living, you still do it, right? Mm-hmm. As a viewer, an audience member, whatever. So you've consumed a lot, but you haven't produced much, chances are, you know, depending on where you are in your life and what else you've done in terms of creative writing. So there was that. And then there was also, and again, this is a little bit more of a function of the fact that it was such a great time to sell originals, but, and what I was saying earlier about, you know, looking around and seeing people selling stuff and thinking, well, I know as much as they do, or, you know, so I really did kind of start thinking, well, why not me? Why not? You know, I've been at this, you know? So I think it's a combination of, again, allowing yourself to be a beginner in a way, and at the same time doing your homework so that you have something to back it up, right? Mm-hmm. That you have educated yourself about the craft. And that's one of my pet peeves, I have to say, is that I think people, a lot of people, by virtue of the fact that they've seen a lot of movies, think it probably is not that hard to write one, right? But
right.
You know, the analogy I always use is like, well, I've driven a lot of cars, but I wouldn't attempt to build one without investigating how an engine works and aerodynamics and those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's also the function of the fact that like not everybody thinks they can play a musical instrument, but everybody can type. Everybody can, you know, they know the alphabet, they got a computer, so,
right.
You know. But there's a little more to it than that. So yeah, you have to do your homework too.
Now what, so we've gone down the rabbit hole of your career and actually just kind of talked all about the business of screenwriting, which is fantastic. And I think it's great, great information that doesn't get talked about often. But let's talk a little bit about the craft, just a little bit about the craft. What are some of the most common mistakes or issues you see in first time screenplays?
Okay. So, I'll do a little plug for myself here. I recently, not that recently now, but a few years ago, wrote a book called Get Your Story Straight about writing a screenplay. And it grew out of my teaching for UCLA. And as I was saying earlier, in terms of like trying to figure out how to teach it, what I wound up doing, you know, what sort of happened was I found myself putting a lot of emphasis on structure. And I know people have a problem with that sometimes. They think of it as formulaic or whatever, mm-hmm. but it's really not. Sorry about the sirens.
It's all good. It's all good. I'm assuming you're in LA, so it's okay.
Yeah, I'm on a busy street. But so I think that's it. I think a lot of times, you know, because the screenplay, it's a marathon. It used to be 120 pages. Now it's maybe 100 to 110. But that's still a lot. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to get lost on that sea of possibilities and write yourself into a corner, to mix my metaphors. And I think, again, getting back to what I was saying about justice and sort of how it's primal, I think that story structure is like, I didn't invent it. You know, this was Aristotle. This is beginning, middle, end. This goes way back. And again, I think is sort of primal. It's kind of like you may not know a lot about music, but you can tell if something doesn't sound right, if it's out of tune or whatever, right? You might not be able to put your finger on why. It's the same thing. It's like we almost have this intuitive sense of like how things ought to be building or moving forward or shifting, you know, as the story progresses. And I think structure is something that's often kind of invisible to the average person. They're not conscious of it, but they are unconsciously aware of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the problems I see most often, you know, that people
structural.
Yeah. They're structural. You know, it's like and that everything needs to have a purpose, right? It's not just random chit chat. It's not, you know, you need to be building. These scenes need to be telling you something that you didn't already know, and they need to be taking you in a specific direction. And you probably better have a pretty good idea of where it is you want to wind up, before you start if you're going to stand any chance of getting there. So, and I also always, you know, the caveat to that is, you know, there are movies that don't follow those, I don't even like to call them rules, principles, maybe, you know, but if you want to do that, well, fantastic, you know, then, but you'll be doing it if you educate yourself about it, you'll be doing it consciously. You'll be breaking those rules consciously instead of you just don't know any better and you're just kind of stumbling around, right?
Right.
Like Charlie Kaufman can do that, right?
Very much so.
But that's a high wire act. You know, I mean, don't try that at home. That is somebody who's at the very top of their craft and a very unique sensibility and all that. For the most part, the vast, vast majority of critically and commercially successful films hit those beats. They just do. And it's funny because even movies that you think of as being, or I think that a lot of people think of as being novel and indie or whatever, you'd be amazed how much they fulfill that. Just recently we screened Little Miss Sunshine and I had them do a worksheet on it. Like, you know, what's the opening image? You know, the opening image in that movie, it's so on target. It's Olive sitting there watching a pageant and it's reflected in her glasses.
Done.
You know, you see that. I mean, it's so perfect. And she's acting it out. So you instantly know what that movie's about, or, you know, you don't know, but in hindsight, like that's what that movie was about. And all those beats, that inciting incident, the first plot point and, you know, the midpoint, and he's just hitting those marks in really inventive and character driven ways. So
very much. So one thing I wanted to ask you as well, what does a scene always have to have in it? Like, what are the elements in the scene? Because you're right. So many times people are just like, so how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing fine. How is that going? And they're like, it's like, no, that's not why we watch a movie, to watch real life. That's called a documentary. What should a scene do? And what elements should be in every scene in your script?
God, I wish I knew. But I will say this, you know, I mean, drama's conflict, right? Somebody should want something. You know, and they probably should, you know, and I wouldn't say always, but oftentimes be going up against somebody else who, you know, doesn't want them to have it, right? That's kind of how you fuel it. But I think, you know, some scenes are more character oriented. They're telling you something more about the person, particularly in the first act, you know, when you're getting the lay of the land. You know, some scenes are really just kind of moving the plot along. We know who these people are by now. You know, you want to be consistent with who they are. But this is what's tricky about it, right? Because you can't really totally boil it down to a formula.
No.
It's the prototype every time out, right? And that's why even people like Sidney Pollack, you know, have their hits and their misses. You know, it's just it's intangible in a way, you know, but, in general, you want to be moving things forward. You don't want to be repeating yourself. And you want the story to be building as you go. And you want there to be something at stake that people care about or understand at least what it means to the protagonist, and that you care about whether or not they get it. Because if you don't care, then the whole thing is moot, right?
Right, right.
That's kind of fundamental.
So then what film, in your opinion, has, as an example, like a perfect setup, structurally speaking, like just like great?
You know, there's quite a number of them because I know this because I teach them in my class. And I don't have anything that's really brand new, but, you know, I try to get to newer things. But Tootsie is genius.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Tootsie's like, I don't know, 8 writers on that.
There was
plus
a bunch
Disney. Right. I mean, credited it's not, but like Elaine May was uncredited on that. You know, Larry Gelbart was on that. Murray Siskel, who was the guy who came up with it with Dustin, you know, and then there were at least 3 or 4 others. I wasn't working for Sidney at the time, but, you know, I'm aware at least 3 or 4 others that, you know, he worked with, plus Sidney, who never took a writing credit, but worked very closely, you know, with people developing scripts. So that's how hard it is. Right. This is how challenging this craft is. You got all those people at the top of their game, and it took them years. That thing did not happen overnight. I think that thing was in development at least 3 or 4 years before. And when they first pitched it to Sidney, when Justin and I guess Murray Siskel first pitched it to Sidney, he's like, you know, and he'd not done comedy. Right. In fact, I think that's his only comedy. And it's really a shame because it's such genius. But he felt like, you know, I don't really do farce. And it's great. I would go see it. You know, if Blake Edwards did it, I'd go see it. But I don't know a way into it. You know, a guy putting on a dress. And apparently in one of those meetings, somebody said something about, you know, how it makes a man out of Michael, like being a woman makes a man out of Michael. And that was what Sidney latched onto thematically. That was what was interesting.
And I'm assuming that is that's a difficult pitch. Like that at that time in history as well, it must have been a difficult pitch.
Yeah, Dustin, and he was a pretty big star.
He was huge, yeah.
And he really wanted to make it, and he really wanted to play it. You know, there was something about playing that character he really sunk his teeth into. But that was the thing that made it interesting for Sidney. It was sort of the larger thematic question that he could explore there. But Toy Story is also masterclass in structure.
Well, pretty much almost every one of their movies is a masterclass in structure. I mean, you could argue. Not all of them.
I'm going to be unpopular here and say that I'm not as big a fan of the Pixar movies as I used to be because this is just me. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're as funny as they used to be. I think they've gotten very sentimental and And I miss the wit, you know, and I don't know if that's just a function that most of the guys, and they are guys, almost all guys, and maybe there's some women now, but who made the bulk of those movies have gotten older. I don't know whether that's just easier and safer, commercially speaking. You know, it is easier, I think, to sort of push those sentimental buttons than it is to be genuinely witty and inspired, especially when you're kind of working on almost like Shakespearean level where you're aiming at kids and adults and everybody in between. But I just think the original Toy Story is genius and so funny and ultimately so touching. But I mean, the idea that Buzz has this existential crisis when he realizes he's not a space ranger. I mean, that right there is just best things ever in a movie. And it's fantastic too, because it's a fantastic character arc, because that's his epiphany. That's the moment that they're able to escape Sid. When you see the light go on in his eyes, and he finally realizes, you know, it's okay not to be a space ranger. You know, he's cool with being Andy's toy.
And isn't it great in the sequel where he actually runs into another Buzz Lightyear who still has that same thing? He's like, oh, you silly, silly man.
The King's Speech is another one that really hits those marks. Sideways really hits those marks. A lot of them. You'd be surprised. In my opinion, pretty much any really successful, commercially, critically, you know, solid movie, you can go through that checklist and identify for yourself those beats. Again, unless it's something very different, like Charlie Kaufman or
Tarantino, Tarantino stuff.
Yeah, yes, exactly. We've got that loopy structure and stuff, you know, which is genius too. But I think even in that, you know, you can identify inciting incidents and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you break Pulp Fiction down and it follows the path, but it's done.
Sure it does. The way it's, yes.
Oh, it's so, but
any of those
literally
movies that jump around in time that way, you know, mm-hmm. like 500 Days of Summer or, they're hitting those marks, but they're doing it in a way that, like, it's like,
It hurts the brain. It hurts the brain to think about how he was able to structure that up. Now, I wanted to touch about, because you touched about this earlier, superhero films. It's obviously so pervasive right now in our culture. I have a Yoda sitting behind me. I have some superhero statues in the back. I'm a huge superhero fan. It's in my generation. I was raised with comic books and stuff, so I love it. But it is now a thing that now studios I remember like 89 when Batman showed up, Tim Burton's Batman, everyone was like, holy cow, a superhero movie that was not Superman circa 1977. Now every week there's a new $300 million movie. What is it about the superhero genre, which Spielberg also said that will eventually go out like the Westerns? I don't know when it'll go out.
I keep waiting.
it's gonna be probably another 30 or 40 years. I mean, they have 40 or 50 years of these characters still going, and then they can reboot it. And as long as people keep showing up,
I know,
they're gonna keep going. But what is it about that genre? What is it about? What's your opinion on the genre? And better question is, like, is there anything that could be done with screenwriters coming up in this genre?
You know, I am not the person to ask, because I really. I'll admit that up front. I've tried. I really have tried, because I know that's what the kids are saying. You know what I mean? I know, of course, I am well aware of how popular these things are, mm-hmm. but they just make my eyes glaze over.
Well, how about Nolan's work?
Christopher Nolan?
Yes.
Like, see,
the Dark Knight?
No, I haven't seen it. I'll confess.
I'll
tell you this. I love Iron Man.
Okay.
Because it's Robert. Uh-huh. And because it's John Favreau. And I love John Favreau. Uh-huh. I think John Favreau is fantastic. So there's wit in that movie. I think that's the thing for me. I like things that make me laugh. And I'm bored by watching an action sequence that goes on for 20 minutes. I mean, how many times can you watch things blow up? How many times can you watch, you know, giant figures punch each other? I just don't find it entertaining. I wish I did, because clearly there's money to be made, you know? And I feel a little left out in the cold at this point, but they don't entertain me. I never read comic books. I'm not interested. I think the original Superman is brilliant because, again, it's character, right? There's mm-hmm. wit and there's romance and there's character and there's tongue in cheek, you know, and maybe some of these movies have that and I've mm-hmm. missed the ones that do. But like you said, there's a new one every week and I it's not my thing.
The one thing, the only movie I will suggest you do, only one I would say you watch is The Dark Knight. It is arguably the godfather of superhero movies. And if you take the superhero element out of it, is basically an amazing heist film. Just a heist film mixed with a crime drama thriller. It, you know, if you take – because a lot of these, you take the suit off, it's done.
Right, right.
Christopher Nolan did such a good job that in that – the second one, not the first. The first one's great and the third one's good, but the second one is – that's the reason why we have 10 – that's why we have 10 Oscar nominees. And because of that movie.
Right, right.
It was so good.
Interesting. Well, and this is not superhero, but, you know, it's not like I don't like, not that anybody cares really.
Right.
Like, you know, darker movies.
Sure.
Like, really, a movie that I love, actually, that I was also just pointing out to my students because of the final battle in it, is Aliens, the second one.
So
that Tim Cameron did. Which I just think is genius. You know, it's so suspenseful, but again, great characters. You know, Paul Reiser is so scary in that movie. Like, you can't believe he's that bad a villain, and he's frightening.
He's normal looking. But he's normal looking. That's the thing that's so frightening about him.
Oh, and we're used to seeing him in comedy. And then again, Sigourney Weaver's incredible, and
Bill
the little
Paxton.
Girl is
Bill
so
Paxton.
Good. Oh my God, Bill Paxton. I
God
know.
Bless.
I
Rest
know.
In peace. game over, man. And I would argue, and I know I might get crap for this on people listening, but I'm like, there honestly hasn't been a James Cameron film that he's made really that I don't like. I think they all have. I mean, he's just one of the, like, The Abyss. I thought was.
I actually never saw The Abyss. I was not a big fan of Avatar. In fact, I felt like Avatar was a bit of a ripoff of Aliens.
Avatar was a ripoff of Ferngully. It was a ripoff of a billion other things. But it hits those – he was able to hit those buttons so everyone was a bullseye. Everyone was a bullseye. And then you mix that in with insane technology, insane spectacle.
Exactly. And clearly that's part of its success. And probably a lot of people who loved Avatar never saw Aliens, you know, and didn't realize the extent to which, you know, he was kind of ripping himself off. But I also think, you know, Aliens had wit. I mean, so, you know, if you can combine all those things, it's fantastic. But to me, I just feel like so much of the superhero movies are the ones I've seen. And again, I haven't seen very many, but the ones I've seen and or even Wonder Woman, like I heard so much about Wonder Woman. And of course I wanted to, you know, applaud it. But it wasn't that great. I'm sorry. It really wasn't. I was expecting Superman, and maybe the bar was too high, but in terms of like the relationship between her and I can't even remember the guy now. I just really expected more of it. It looked great. She looked great, you know, but that whole third act is same old, you know, I don't know. I mean, hey, listen, I'm not an easy person to go see movies with.
Fair enough. Now,
I'll confess, you know, whatever you do, you're that much more critical of. So, yeah.
So what can
let me just say, mm-hmm. I will say this. Mm-hmm. When something's really good, in my humble opinion, I appreciate it so much because I know how hard it is. I really do.
I agree. When I see, like, I saw Green Book and I was just like, well, that's just great. I mean, it was just so well. It's literally two guys in a car.
Yeah.
And it just held you. And it was wonderful performances, wonderful writing, wonderful directing. It was just hitting every I don't know if it was Best Picture, but it was still arguably one of the best films I saw this last year. But yeah, when you find it, when you see it, if it keeps me up past my bedtime, that means it's a good movie.
Yeah, and you want to see it again because you want to see how they did what they did, you know? Yeah. That's something, for what it's worth, I really recommend to your listeners and writers, is if there's something you really like, watch it and read it and watch it and read it over and over and over. I feel like it seeps into you, the rhythms of it, you know, even if you feel like you know it forwards and backwards, if you can still learn from it and really dissect how they're doing what they're doing. Look at how it looks on the page. Look at how, you know, has it made it to the screen in that form? Has it been changed? That kind of thing. Just really do the forensics.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, and yeah, of course. I worked in a video store, so I saw thousands and thousands of movies, and that's how I kind of got started in my business, just watching. It was the first time in history that you could do that when the VHS came out.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, before then, you have to wait for the movies to come back.
Yeah, and you couldn't get scripts.
I mean, you couldn't pause it and rewind it.
Yeah.
And you couldn't have Martin Scorsese talking to you.
Excuse now. Come on.
There's no excuse. No excuse whatsoever. Now, your book, tell me a little bit about your book. I want to get people to, if they're interested in it, where they can get it, what's it about?
It's called Get Your Story Straight. It's on Amazon. Like I said, it kind of grew out of my teaching for UCLA. And in it, I really go into what I think are the important elements of a functioning screenplay. And I use a lot of examples. Like I was saying, I dissect a movie at the end of, maybe not every chapter, but almost every chapter, including Iron Man and King's Speech and Sideways and Tootsie and Toy Story. So they're kind of all over the map. Thumb and Louise, you know.
Classic.
A lot of them are winning screenplays. Yeah, genius. Thumb and Louise so holds up. It's amazing how well that movie holds up.
So good.
That sequence, I'm just going to go off on a tangent here quickly. The sequence, because sometimes I talk about turnarounds, the sequence where they get stopped by the cop and Thelma, you know, starts in that sequence as like a little girl. You know, she's like, please, 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 please don't let us get stopped. Please don't let us get stopped. You know, and then the cop comes up to the car, and then she's sort of coquettish. You know, it's like, officer, I told her to slow down. You know, and that doesn't work either. And he makes Louise get out of the car and makes her go sit in the police car. And then, you know, Thelma appears at the window with the gun and starts calling the shots.
Oh,
you know?
So
like,
brilliant.
Shoot the radio. I mean, so you see that character arc in that sequence, you know, and it's just so brilliant. And it's so brilliant, too, because you believe it. Right. Because we know she's met Brad Pitt and we know there's money been stolen. And we know, you know, she's desperate at this point. She's also, you know, had this little quick romance with him and yet he's taken their money, but he's taught her how to rob. I mean, so it's not like it's not set up, you know, it like you don't see it coming. And yet at the same time, it's like, well, yeah, I could buy that she would do that. So
it's such a great movie. I know we are going on a tangent, but that was a great movie. Ridley Scott directed it. And people like Ridley Scott, like when he did that movie, it was like, what? The guy who did Blade Runner and Alien is doing Thelma Louise.
I know. And yet it's visually so stunning. You know,
it's Ridley.
Yeah. So great. Anyway, so about the book. So yeah, so that's what the book is. But thank you for that.
And then what else are you up to? What other things do you do?
So I teach, I do consulting, I do private consulting, I speak, which I really enjoy. Last year, and I'm doing it again this July, I was a mentor at a retreat at this castle in France called Marowat Castle.
Tough job.
Are some perks. Anyway, it's Miles Copeland. I don't know if you know that music producer. He used to produce The Police. It's his castle. But it's fantastic. It's just a great experience. And then I'm going to do another one of those in a monastery off Naples.
It's rough.
This is the best part, honestly, of like being a writer. Anyway, that's in April of 2020, the Italy one. So I do that, and I'm working on something. I haven't written anything in a while for all the reasons we discussed. I do have a story I want to tell. So
good.
A lot of people have told me I should write it as a book. For a number of reasons. Hollywood's more interested in books right now than they are in original
IP.
Screenplays.
IP.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's really true. I mean, the manager who came to speak at my seminar or whatever at UCLA recently was saying literally even self-published books they're more interested in than they are in an original screenplay. Like that it is, sort of doesn't matter. It's as long as it's something else first, mm-hmm. it's stunning. But having said that, you know, I've spent all these years in screenwriting. That's what comes to me naturally. And to try to write it as a novel, although the thought of like not having anybody mess with it is really appealing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of daunting to me. So we'll see. But
I'll tell you what, if I can write a book, because I have a story that I had to tell, and I wrote a book that just got released about a crazy story in my life as a filmmaker, and it got published, and people are already asking me, when's the movie coming out? Because a friend of mine wanted me to write the screenplay. I'm like, I'm not going to write the screenplay. I'm not going to go chase money for a screenplay. And I can't tell the whole story in a screenplay. It's going to be so much more difficult. But what is a lot of freedom in a novel. It is a tremendous amount. And I've written more screenplays than I've written anything else in my life.
Really?
It just flows. It's nice. It's nice.
Well, you've encouraged me. I appreciate that. I don't know. I don't literally like kind of know how to do it on the page. I'm so used to being spare, you know? Like now I've got head and I've got to like, you know, they said, you know, it's like, I find that really challenging. Maybe I should just like map it all out and then try.
It's like speaking publicly, doing a 10-minute speech versus a 3-hour speech. Like it's much harder to do a 10-minute speech than it is to do a 3-hour speech, because 3 hours you can just meander and tell stories. And
so you think the novel is like the 3-hour speech?
Absolutely, because I was able to go into places and tell little detailed stories and then not have to be so precious with the words. Because when you're a screenwriter, they just beat you down with like every single word has to mean something. The description has to move the story. Where in a novel, you could just – you literally just all the chains are off and you could just write. And it is honestly for me as a screenwriter and as a writer, it was so freeing. I would I'm just going to write 1,000 words today, and I just write 1,000 words, and I'm going to write another 1,000 words today. And there's no, the structure is so much more freeing. As a writer, it feels so much better for me. I do think that novel writers have an extremely difficult time becoming screenwriters. But I think screenwriters have a much easier time become novel writers. I had Doug Richardson, the screenwriter from Bad Boys and Die Hard 2 on. And Doug, he's writing novels now. He's a series of novels. And he still writes screenplays, but he's like, oh man, it's just so great. Because you could play. And what you said, it's yours. No one's going to mess with a word.
Well, that's the biggest thing, you know. I mean, obviously, you got editors, you know, if you get that far, you have editors. It's a whole other, that is something that, you know, is, I think, kind of unique to screenwriting. It's like, you know, if you're a painter or a poet or whatever, you do it and maybe people like it or they don't like it or whatever, but nobody's like, let's put a little more red on that, you know.
Right.
Your own brush. Yeah. So,
well, I hope I've encouraged you to write in a novel.
It's a good perspective shift for me. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests, what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
You know, I think, if you happen to be a minority, there's never been a better time, right? Yeah. So many fellowships, diversity fellowships, programs out there, particularly in television. I think vast majority are in television, but all these, you know, platforms and networks and everything, as we discussed, have so much, you know, time to feed, you know, and there's unlimited with Netflix, right?
Oh, Netflix is just starting. There's so many streaming. I think there's like 2,000 shows going on right now. It's insane.
Crazy. You know, and who knows how long that's going to be the case, but for the time being, there's that there's that market to fill, and there's a lot of heat on these organizations to open doors to people who always have been kept out, basically. So if you're if you fall into that category, I would absolutely encourage people to pursue those fellowships and you know, do your homework on that. And that's easy to find on Google, that stuff. And then there's the contests, you know, there's a handful that I think really sort of matter. Nickel is one.
Austin.
Film Festival, probably Final Draft. You know, there might be a couple more that I'm not thinking of right now. But that's kind of a way to get noticed, you know. And then, you know, the other thing is, and this is the trick, right? It's like, go do your own little thing. So there's this democratization of the technology, right? But at the same time, there's so much clutter out there. Mm-hmm. So that's hard to rise above. But, you know, I always say, and I always add that, you know, sometimes I wish this weren't the case when my work doesn't seem to catch fire, you know. But I really do believe if you write something good enough, and that bar is very, very high, but if you do, it will get noticed. People will talk about it. They will talk to their friends about it, and it will spread, and you will get somewhere with it. But, you know, Michael Arndt, you know, who wrote Little Miss Sunshine, there's a great clip of video of him online, if people are interested, where he talks about sort of his inspiration for that movie and the origins of it. And he's really lovely. But one of the things he talks about is how he was a reader before he became a writer. Mm-hmm. I think he was from Matthew Broderick. And he says, I believe it's in that clip, where he says, you know, that I realize the town is kind of a wash in B minus to B plus scripts, and that a lot of them just didn't ultimately fully deliver, particularly in the end. And it was very important to him that that ending on Little Miss Sunshine really said something.
Oh, it did.
And yeah, you know, like it went away you didn't expect, and yet it made perfect sense, and it tied everything together thematically and, you know, story-wise and everything. So I think that's true. You know, I think to write a B script, it's probably not going to get you that far. But if you can either, you know, whether it's in the conception of the idea that's so unique that it's like Jurassic Park or something, you know, that it just really is just almost sells itself that way, or your execution is really so masterful. And that is hard. That's really hard. And you have, and it doesn't happen in one or two drafts. You know, you have to really be willing to keep at it.
Now, what can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
I wish you'd ask me these questions about what book had the biggest impact. You know, I can't think of one in particular. There's a book I really, really love. I don't know that it had the biggest impact on me, but it's called West with the Night. It's actually set in Africa, and people wanted Sidney to make it after he did Out of Africa. And it's a true story, too, but he'd already done Out of Africa.
So. Sure.
He wasn't going to go back there. But that's a brilliant, brilliant book written by a woman who was a pilot, in a bush pilot at the same era of Isaac Dinesen and Ava. But what I will say is after I quit business school and was thinking of going to law school, when I was in college, I didn't take any – well, I took one literature class, and I hated it because they made us read books I didn't like. And so – which is kind of like being forced to eat food you don't want to eat, you know, mm-hmm. and – irony of ironies, that's what my living became, was reading stuff I didn't want to read, reading screenplays. But for whatever reason, I just decided when I got out that I wanted to have a better understanding of classic literature. And so I did my own little self-directed course, I guess, of reading the classics. Sort of right after I got out of college. So I read, because I wanted to know what people talked about Moby Dick, or they talked about Grapes of Wrath, or you know, Jane Austen, or whoever, Tolstoy. Sure. You know, I wanted some familiarity with that. I don't honestly really even know why, but I did. And what I learned from that was, it just taught me a lot about the universality of human nature. You know, like at the time, like, you know, it was still the Soviet Union and they were like the big red menace and I knew nothing about Soviet. And then I read Tolstoy and it's like, oh, but they're just like people.
Right, right.
I mean, obviously he was pre-Soviet Union, but you know what I'm saying? Like that this Russian guy, you know, from the 1800s, right? He was 1800s, I believe, could speak to me, you know, in the 20th century was astonishing to me, but he really did. And that's Shakespeare, right? That's the things don't change that much. And so I think collectively that experience really, it gave me a lot. And I think it also gave me kind of confidence in my ability as a reader. And that was, you know,
very good. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Wow. What am I still learning? You know, I'll say this. It gets back a little bit to what we're talking about, justice, you know. And you stay in this business long enough, some really shitty stuff is going to happen to you. It's just going to. Mm-hmm. And like I said, nobody is immune. And it's ugly. It is uglier than you can possibly imagine, than I could have possibly imagined. The other side of that coin is it can be incredibly exciting and incredibly fun. And I got to go to Italy and hang out with Robert Downey Jr. You know what I mean? It's like, but it runs the gamut. But I do remember having a point a long time ago in my life where I thought, you know, you either need to just accept that this is the nature of the game, you know, this is the nature of the beast, or you need to get out because you are not going to change this. And no. So, yeah, you're not. Now, having said that, I still have difficulty with that. And I will say, in the wake of the Me Too stuff, part of me is like, hats off, you know, for your collectively, for those women collectively going, no, you know what, it's not okay. And we are going to try to change it. And, you know, maybe they will in the long run, maybe they won't. I don't know. But I really give them credit for having finally said, no, we're not just going to say that's how it works. That's how the business is. No. You know, there's nothing we can do. So you have to, I think, almost have like a duality, you know, where it's like, okay, this is the way it is. And you do your best to cope with it and just keep your head down, you know, do your work. That in the end, I think, is your salvation, is do your work, do the best you can and strive as you do that, because this is so critical, to be inspired by the work that you admire and the work you love and really seek that out, because that's what feeds you.
And the toughest question of all, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, my goodness. See, now this is so hard. Well, I would put Thelma and Louise up there. Okay. I really would. I love that movie. Gosh, let me think here for a minute. I mean, there's little movies that I love. I don't know if I put them in my all time, but they just touch me, like Il Postino. I love Il Postino.
Oh, I love Postino. It's beautiful.
It's just so beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's just so quirky and sweet and beautiful. I really like Pulp Fiction.
Oh, I love Pulp Fiction.
Butch Cassidy, maybe. I love old Paul Newman. Yeah.
Anything Goldman.
I cheated. Yeah, and anything, really, truly.
Princess Bride.
Misery. I mean, come on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All the President's Men, all of them. He's just genius. And they all hold up so well.
And where can people find you in the work you're doing?
They can go to my website, which is just DianeDrake.com, and they can reach me there.
Very cool. Well, Diane, it has been an amazing conversation. I'm so glad it went into places I wasn't expecting, which I love, which is great. And you really dropped some knowledge bombs on the tribe today about the realities of being in this business, and hopefully some inspiration and some cautionary tales as well. So thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. It was really fun.
I want to thank Diane for being so honest and so straightforward with her experiences, her knowledge bombs, all the information that she gave us in this episode. I really, really appreciate it. So Diane, thank you. Thank you so much for coming by and dropping those knowledge bombs on the tribe. If you want to get any information about Diane, her consulting, her books, links to her movies, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/BPS046. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really, really, really helps us out a lot. The more reviews we get, the higher we're ranked on iTunes, and the more people can get access to this information. I want to get this out to as many screenwriters as humanly possible. So thanks again, guys, for listening. And as always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.